Just 27th class? 27th class on April the 29th, 2008, then and now. And this evening we're going to be focusing on generosity. Carol, what was the assignment I gave?
We were supposed... Is it on?
I think it's the 28th class.
Maybe it is the 28th class.
Okay, then it's the 28th class.
We're getting up there.
We're getting up there. I figure it'll be about 40 by the time we finish. Close to. Yes.
Our assignment was to focus on... No, what did you say? Explore. Practicing generosity with the absence of an I or an other. What do the six perfections become?
When do the six perfections become perfections?
Right.
Yes. Okay, what was your experience with this? You said you had some strange comments about your strange behavior.
Well, it wasn't really strange behavior, but I was tipping a lot, like in cafes or something, like in a coffee shop. But I would always wait until the person whom I was tipping was like walking away so they couldn't see me do it. And one of my friends said, wasn't the whole point that they see you put the dollar in the jar? and I was like, no, it's not. That's not the whole point. Like, I want to be, I don't know. There's something in me that, like, for me, just a small, I don't want to say victory, but like, it was a small enough daily practice for me to realize that I can be generous without having to be recognized.
Great. Okay. Anybody else?
I'm not going to wait to be asked.
How kind of you.
It's a risk, but I'll take it. It's always amazing to me that I understand the question in class, or I think I understand the question in class or the practice, and then I get home and I realize I have no idea at all. Not that what you were talking about, but there's this whole matrix of things, you know, this generosity fits into this matrix of thoughts and ideas and things I've been told over the years. And I have to sit and see what it means to me in terms of experience. And in terms of a practice, one thing I realized was that generosity has no downside whatsoever.
That's a good way of putting it.
In terms of generosity without a self or without a giver and a receiver, I found that I failed entirely. I found that I couldn't be generous without a self and an other. And that was all right for a while, but I started to think, well, can I practice in the moment? Can I just say to myself in the moment, I'm driving home, say. I say, do I need to plan my next generosity by finding somebody who needs something? Or can I just be generous in this moment? And if I can, what does that mean, being generous in this moment? Well, it could be generous to other drivers, or it could be generosity to self. For example, not being judgmental of self or critical. But that still involves this. I'm making myself into another from the observer self. And then something occurred to me that you said during class, and I've heard you say it before, and I'm going to get it wrong probably, but the one thing you know about when you give something is that you have to let go of it. You have to let go of something. And I realized that the only thing that can be given or let go of without a giver and receiver, without a self and other, is self itself. And when I got there, I realized that, well, yeah, it can be anytime, anywhere.
When one of your daughters asks for something, what happens?
an extraordinarily complex calculation.
None of your daughters. Are we okay, Molly? When one of your daughters is upset and needs something, what happens?
I go to her aid.
How much do you think about it?
Not a whole lot.
Like about zero?
I don't think it's zero. I think it never actually evaporates. I don't think that the relationship never evaporates, the self-other, for me at this point. It becomes clearer and more direct. I was thinking that... If I saw an enlightened being give something to another, it would appear to me to be generosity. But in fact, it would not be generosity. It would be acting properly in a situation. The very fact of calling it generosity is conditional, is this side of, it's a practice.
Okay, we'll come back to this later. Okay, Randy. I understand what you're pointing to there, Joe. It's interesting, but what I'm pointing to, I'll get to later. Okay.
Yeah, I had kind of the same problems Joe did.
You guys think too much.
Well, I also sort of misunderstood the assignment because most of my practice was on the cushion rather than in vivo. And when I did that, I could feel it much more. You know, my imagination must be better than the reality. But what it felt like was not giving or doing, but just being.
Mm-hmm.
It did not feel like I was letting go of anything.
Mm-hmm.
It just felt like I was being and mm-hmm. being me. And it was, and then, so the question comes up is, can you still call it generosity? It doesn't feel like it. It just feels
this is
like
why I
being.
Say, this is why I say you guys think too much. There's a microphone, another mic right behind you.
You can define the opposite behavior quite easily of not being generous. Do you know what I mean? So, like, if you're being yourself and you're being generous, then can you call it generosity? But if you're being...
Well, just a second. There's a mic there, Randy, if you want one.
Thank you.
This wonderful Puritanism creeping in here. Philosophical Puritanism.
I'm not a Puritan.
I know, that's where it comes from.
For me, it was more etymology. You know, the word generosity brings up...
That's the philosophy side. Okay, just take what Randy's talking about. Which is really what I was trying to point to with this exercise. And I was trying to point Joe to this. A situation arises, and without actually thinking about anything, you give something. That is generosity. Arguably, it's the perfection of generosity because there's no conception of self or other. It is just an immediate response. And of course, now the philosophers say, well, since there wasn't any sense of self or other, can you really call it generosity? And Yes, you can. And you get it all the relative and absolute stuff, and that's where I say you're thinking too much.
Generosity to feel like.
Now we're getting, yes. It didn't feel like what I was expecting it to feel like. And that's often the case. In many respects, when you are truly present, it feels like nothing at all. Chuang Tzu refers to this in his writings in Taoism. When the shoe fits, you forget the foot. When the belt fits, you forget the waist. That's true. So when you make the appropriate response in a situation, it doesn't feel like anything at all. That's what I was pointing to. And that's what we're going to be working towards in this chapter. Okay, good. So, let us turn. In Kinchuk Jeltsin's book, you're on page 183. In Gunther, we're on 152. Now, in the next six chapters, including this one, we're going to be using the same framework for discussion. Gunther calls it liberality. I think generosity is probably the better translation. But each of these perfections is going to be discussed under seven headings. And it's wonderful, these mistranslations. Reflection on the faults and virtues. It's not the faults of generosity or the defects of generosity, that's quite misleading. It is the faults, the defects, the problems when you don't practice generosity. And the qualities or the virtues or whatever that come from practicing generosity. So it's not the faults or virtues of the action itself, but of whether you're practicing it or not. That's the first one. Its essence, that's like what's its essential gesture? You know, in generosity, it's opening. It's letting go. Classification, that's straightforward. The primary characteristics of each class, that's straightforward. And then its increase. This would be more about how to develop it or how to make it stronger or extend its scope, so forth. In particular, it's about how to extend its the depth and range that it of its influence in you, not so much in other people, but in your experience. Purification. What's being talked about in under those headings is how does it move from being ordinary generosity to the perfection of generosity? And then, and the same with all the other ones when we get there. And then the result, and again we have to refer to, we talk about result. You've heard me talk about karma as evolution, and I've used the term genesis to give this idea of things growing into other things, like acorns growing into oak trees and apple seeds growing into apple trees and so forth. So when we talk about a result, it's not what generosity is causing, it's what does it actually grow into. Here's generosity as being viewed as the genesis of a process, and what is the end outcome of that process. You know, outcome might be a better word than result. If we're going to use genesis, have to think about that. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
Okay. So now I have to chuckle when I read this. Have we talked about rational choice theory here yet? Yeah. Julia knows all about this. Okay. Rational choice theory, and Julia can correct me if I get this wrong, and you should know about this, Randy, is the theory that if a person or an entity, like an organization or something, is given all the appropriate information, then they will make a choice that maximizes their interests. So it's utility theory, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, almost all economics is based on rational choice theory or utility theory. And it has spread into, to some extent, into sociology, probably a little bit even into psychology.
And foreign policy.
There's only one small problem. There's a tremendous amount of research, and we all know that this is only one of several ways we make decisions. So we have very, very large systems of thought which determine the actions of states and individuals and policy, which is based on a completely, not completely, but a largely inaccurate theory. It just enables the mathematics to be done more easily. So it's an example of that Nasruddin joke where Nasruddin's had a little too much to drink. And a policeman finds him groping around on the street under a light. I said, "What are you doing, Nasruddin?" I said, "I'm looking for my keys." "Well, where did you lose them?" And Nasruddin points out into the middle of the street where it's completely dark. He says, "Out there." "Well, why are you looking here?" "Because the light's much better." Now, don't laugh. I went to a lecture at UCLA on functional MRI and brain measurements and what they were trying to do. And when I listened to it, I put out my hand and said, "Well, according to what you're saying, this phenomenon that you're looking for is not going to be where you're measuring. Why are you looking for it there?" And the reply was, "Because we can measure it there. Because we can measure it there." And it was, I just couldn't believe it. It was almost verbatim, this, you know, because the light's much better. And so I just sort of walked out at that point. It was unbelievable. So this whole section is totally about rational choice theory. That here are all the terrible things that are going to happen if you don't practice generosity, and here are all the good things that are going to happen if you practice generosity. So I would just like to ask all of you quite candidly, is this going to make any difference to you?
Yes.
If I tell you it's a good thing to practice generosity and terrible things are going to, you know, really unfortunate things are going to happen to you if you don't practice generosity, is that going to make any difference to you? No. Why not, Joe? I like that. No. Pardon? Oh, okay. Is that better? Any missed? Pardon? I'm a bit fuzzy. Well, it is okay. Please go ahead, Joe.
Well, because I don't know if what you say or what this book says is true. I don't know if that's true.
You mean the descriptions you're going to be born in the Praetor realms and, or the Hungry Ghost realms and things like that. Okay, well, that's a very good one. Yeah, you know, so the described outcomes, you have no basis to which to appraise their facticity here. Okay, suppose you knew them to be true. There was a way.
Would I always do them?
No. Would it make any difference to be told? You know, it says, "Oh yeah, okay, yes." You know, and for instance, I mean, we can make it a little more immediate. Yeah. Well, let's take it further. Usually, you know, if you give to this charity, people are going to think well of you.
Yeah, and what? What's the question?
So, would this make any difference? And if you don't give to this charity, people won't think well of you. They'll, you know, you're going to be, you know, people will think, you know, well, why isn't he doing that? They're you're going to encounter opprobrium and shame.
Okay, I don't know quite how to answer this. Yes, at some points that would make me do it when I feel like I need to be approved of. At certain times, I don't feel need to be approved, and I would not do it.
Well, yeah, you're getting at the point that I'm trying to get at, is because what I find somewhat ironic here is they're talking about the perfection of generosity, and the first thing there that Gampopa is talking about is how it is in your interest to do this, which is not exactly what the perfection of generosity is actually about. That's what I wanted to get. Kara, you had a comment? Miss Jo, there's something you wanted to say?
Yeah. On that same line, I noticed it says it should not be done with a fear of poverty, and yet at the same time it emphasizes what you're going to get out of it.
You're going to be so wealthy if you do this. Yeah, I don't know. Okay, Kara.
Well, but when you say that, I get all these like alarm bells of like formal religion and you know, the way, the truth, and the light, and like that. And if you know that something is going to, it just makes me think of opposites. Like if I know that generosity is going to give me X, Y, and Z, and then I'm not generous, I'm not going to get X, Y, and Z, and then I somehow feel guilty, and it leads to shoulds and shouldn'ts and
exactly
like that. Yeah. And so I feel like if it's, just like you said, if it's something that's born of your natural state, then that's when it's...
And we have to remember, this text was written in some time in the 12th, early, late 12th, early 13th century. That's 1,700 years after Buddha lived. This whole line of thought really developed, you know, probably around 600 or 700 years after Buddha lived. So, yes, it really was a religion with all the institutional regalia and the mindsets and things like that. And it's very different from other forms of Buddhism, which didn't stay quite as wedded to institutional forms, but these are expressions which come out very, very much out of an institutionalized form and it's essentially a medieval form. It's very similar in tone to the Catholic Church, the medieval Catholic Church. Yeah. Okay. Randy, do you have some comments?
And just there's another reason that I can find to actually believe, you know, the costs and benefits and the rationality. But like everyone else, I'm more rationalizing than rational. And mm-hmm. I can always find ways to rationalize my behavior to fit into what I think I should be doing.
Yes, we're very good at that, aren't we?
Yes, we are.
Anybody, any other comments? I'm going to just go over this. Joe?
I just have one question. Is it possible? It says it's impure to give with the fear of poverty, but in the terms of this chapter in this book, is it okay to give with a desire for wealth? Is that a distinction that I know it's well, never mind.
Well, no. This is exactly why I'm bringing this up. From my point of view, there's a little problem with pedagogy here. That's what I'm really pointing to. There are mixed messages going on. If you want people to aim at naturally responding to things without thinking, it's probably counterproductive to get them to tell them how wonderful it is if they behave this way, because then the calculating mind immediately comes in. So that's really what I'm pointing to. That being said, I mean, you're saying, I don't know whether all of these things are true, Joe. It's what you're saying a few minutes ago. Well, what happens to you when you refrain from being generous when you have the resources and the opportunity to do so?
That's much clearer.
What happens?
Well, I feel bad, for one thing. I recognize that I'm acting out of a story about myself of lack.
Yep.
Of insufficiency.
Mm-hmm.
All this stuff happens.
This is what it means to be born in the Holy Ghost. Okay. And then we skip down a little bit further. When you don't give and you're known to be a bit of a miser, how many people gather around you?
Not many, but that brings up a point. Why do I want people to gather around me?
You want people to gather around you for two reasons. Okay. One, it gives you opportunities to practice it with interaction. And two, if you're going to help beings, you've got to have some kind of connection with them. Those are the two reasons you want people to... Okay. Now, if we skip down to the bottom of page 152, the liberality of generosity destroys. Gunter's English is so terrible. It ends rebirth. Jesse drove in from Arizona today, that's all. So I wanted to know if you could come to the class, and I said, of course. Ends this business of becoming a hungry ghost, you know, because it's the opposite. You see, A hungry ghost feels there isn't enough out there. So it has a poverty-stricken mentality that it just takes. Well, if you're giving stuff, obviously you're not concerned with there. You feel there's plenty out there because you're just giving stuff away. So it ends that whole mentality internally. As well as poverty and all conflicting passions. Yeah, people who give are generally happier than people who don't. Yes.
But another paradox, I guess, a little further on, it talks about essentially giving according to your means.
Oh, yes.
Which would indicate that you have to sort of calculate how much you need first. Let me
come to that, okay? Because, yes, it could be read that way, but I don't think that's actually what's going on. And during his lifetime, he wins infinite wealth. Well, there's a story from the life of Buddha where this, I can't remember whether it's an old man or an old woman, comes across this wish-fulfilling gem. Yeah. And recognizes for what it is. Oh, this is just amazing. I don't know what to do with this. I'm going to take this to Buddha because he'll know what to do with it. Takes to Buddha and says, here's this wish-fulfilling gem, but I don't have enough knowledge or wisdom to know what to do with this. And I just want you to give it to the person whom you think it is most appropriate to give it. And Buddha immediately calls the king of the region and said, here, take this wish-fulfilling gem. And the old man or woman says, but why? They're wealthier than anybody else. Well, yes, but they have even more. They don't feel that they have what they need to have. So that's why I gave him the wish-fulfilling gem. So when you give, and are able to give generously and freely, without a lot of thought, how wealthy do you feel? You've got everything you need and more because you're giving it away. So when we read this stuff, I really don't think, I mean, you read it literally and it sounds really nice. But, and you can certainly interpret it at that level, but then it is very calculating and very materialistic, etc. But if I think you read it at an internal level, okay, what actually happens when we practice generosity? Well, we become wealthy, not in the sense that we have lots and lots of stuff, but in the sense we have no feeling of poverty. Is it making sense? Yeah. So this is one of the things I want to point out about this, is that I think this has to be read on that interior level as well. And moving on to some of its qualities, you take this, by the practice of generosity, one can fully mature sentient beings who are suffering. This is about two-thirds of the way, three-quarters of the way down on page 184. And Gunther translated as liberality brings suffering beings to maturity. Different interpretation in the translation. But this goes back to what we were talking about last week. Is that that opening and the letting go, which is absolutely necessary for generosity, starts the process of what becomes ultimately the letting go of self. So when you read lines like this, again, it's referring to the unfolding of the whole process. It's not just, it's certainly not simple cause and effect. The quotation from the Household Drakshulchen Requested Sutra is very interesting. A thing which is given is yours, things left in the house are not. A thing which is given has essence, things left in the house have no essence. A thing which has been given need not be protected, things kept in the house must be protected. A thing which is given is free from fear, things kept in the house are with fear. A thing which is given is closer to enlightenment, things left in the house go in the direction of the Maras. What do you make of this? Julie? Alex, can you help?
I saw it as a distinction between things that are sort of hoarded in some way and things that are charged with some intention.
Go on.
Of transferring to somebody.
Mm-hmm. Anything else?
I don't know how else to say it. It's just this sense of a movement of energy. An object being a gesture rather than something that's just static and sitting
yes.
there and not fulfilling a purpose.
I think that's very much what's going on here. I agree. A thing that is sitting in your home that you're keeping is not doing anything in the world,
right.
is not actually influencing.
When
you give it, it's now, as you said, set in motion.
Mm-hmm.
And so it becomes active in the world. So that's how it becomes yours. You know what the Zen people do with this? They just say it so much more concisely. Gain is illusion, loss is enlightenment.
Ah.
It's from Uchiyama. I was reading this and went, oh, I've come across this before. And it's something really, it's really good to keep that in mind. And I had a student in Orange County, and when he hit, we were reading Uchiyama's Refining Your Life together. When he hit this chapter, he just came and said, what does this mean? Gain is illusion, loss is enlightenment. It just really upset him. But we had a good discussion.
Sense here that's not exactly loss, just a static.
Yeah.
Because loss is a perceived.
Yes, I agree. These aren't exactly the same.
Mm.
This also reminds me there's a Thai, I'm pretty sure he's Thai. Scholar, who's, if I remember his name correctly, it's Pagotal, who writes a lot on interpreting Buddhism in the modern world. And the those of you who did the Money and Value workshop, I drew some of the stuff from him on Buddhist economics. And much of what he is talking about when he looks at the Theravada, he's not even looking at the Mahayana sutras, he's looking at the Theravada sutras, he finds a great deal in there which is all about keeping things in flow, which is exactly, you know, basic economic principles. I mean, as long as the money keeps moving, everybody's happy. It's when it stops that you get really bad problems, which is exactly what happened in the Great Depression, is that everybody locked the credit down, so money stopped flowing, and then there was no economic activity for a very long time or very little. And it's why what people are very concerned about now with this liquidity crisis is the money, the fact that there is so much bad debt out there, like these things really are worthless, that people will just stop lending. And then the whole global economic machine grinds to a halt, and it takes quite a while to get it started again. So that's why the central banks are taking actions that they are. So keep things moving, and I think what Julia was saying is also right on point. Implicit in this, even though it's not said at all explicitly, is the idea that things are not things, things are movements. And this reminds me of very much of a book that I've mentioned before, Against Essentialism, which is a very high-level book on sociology theory, which really is a prolonged 200-page argument for not regarding things as things, but regarding things as relationships, very close to this idea of regarding things as movements. So now, we can do that intellectually. What we're actually working towards is not so much regarding things as movements, but experiencing things as movements and relationships rather than as entities. That's the difference between this form of practice and an intellectual or cognitive understanding of that idea. Yes. Right there.
When I read that, I got part of that. But also what resonated more with me is that when it moves, it increases in value. Because mm-hmm. when I'm full and I give food to somebody who's hungry, they need it more than I do. And they will appreciate it more because they're hungry and they need the food. And that's why I give it to them, because mm-hmm. I don't need it and they do.
Because it has no value to you, but it has value to them. It increases
so that's,
its value.
That, yeah. to me, tied in that increase in wealth that there somewhere earlier you mentioned.
Has anybody developed an economic theory based on that principle?
Yes, well, all shadow pricing in economics is based on that principle. All welfare economics.
Just need to catch it.
All of welfare economics is based on that principle. A bowl of rice is more valuable if it's given to somebody who's hungry than if it's given to somebody who has already eaten 12 bowls in a row. The shadow price of the rice is basically its utility in a distributive sense. So welfare economics is inherently interested in distribution effects, whereas the kind of neoclassical economics that's promoted by the Chicago school in this country,
which has become
the dominant economic view in this country, is not interested in distributive effects. And that's why it's been so powerful in influencing neoconservative thought.
Yeah, so this is supply-side economics.
Well, that's a little bit of a wrinkle on it. But, I mean, this basic idea that distribution doesn't matter.
I wondered what was behind that. Okay, thanks. Because it's been quite destructive.
The long dead hand of Adam Smith.
I don't think it was Adam Smith, because he was very much concerned with distribution and the effects of stuff, wasn't he?
As interpreted by the neoclassical school.
Ah, well, yes, that's very different.
That's a big proviso, yes.
Yes, because Adam Smith was always talking about closed economic systems so that the people had to experience the effects of their economic actions.
Yes, where we've now got a whole system set up where nobody does that.
Yeah, where everything is to insulate yourself. From
Versailles.
Yes. Okay. Kara, you were going to say something?
From what Randy said, backtracking a little bit about having a bowl of rice and then giving it to someone else who doesn't have one,
mm-hmm.
it's all kind of muddled now. That was a big thought. But
we like big thoughts here.
I do like big thoughts. Or everyone here does. I like sleep too. Need to get more of that. If anyone has any extra sleep and would like to give it to me, be happy to take it. I need it more than you do. it's true. It's the future. But what I was going to say is that a lot of times, I think hearkening back to the beginning of the class, you know, like the separation that they're talking about, you know, it's going to be good for you if you do this or you do that. I think that if you have an equation where there's a separation between the recipient and the giver, then there's somehow an expectation that you have that if you give them that bowl of rice, that they're going to be grateful. And I think that on an emotional and a financial level, that becomes an even more negative equation than just simply not giving somebody something.
Yeah, that's treated very definitely later in this chapter.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Definition. I love it. A mind co-emergent with non-attachment, with that motivation, fully giving things. Let's see if we can get an even worse definition out of Gunther. It is an unattached and spontaneous mind and the dispensing of gifts and requests in that state of mind. Actually, Gunther's is more intelligible. What do you get out of this wonderful definition?
Nothing.
Nothing, okay. Monea? I could tell you were hiding something back there.
No, I need you to repeat that again, though.
Okay. But do you want Gunther or Kencho
Jeltsin?
A mind co-emergent with non-attachment, with that motivation fully giving things. Yeah, this is such crystalline English. Do you want Gunther?
Sure.
It is an unattached and spontaneous mind and the dispensing of gifts and requests in that state of mind.
I have a question about this.
Good. Fire away.
So what I'm hearing is action or energy that is born of emptiness.
Yep.
There really isn't much more to say, I guess. It's just a lot of words to say.
To say what you said, actually, much more nicely, as far as I'm concerned. Yeah.
But they have to sound smart.
Well, that's the trick. It is very important to seem smart, isn't it? Okay. Classification. Wealth, fearlessness, and the giving of Dharma. And then he goes into a long thing about impure giving, which is actually worth... Now, none of this is about the perfection of generosity. This is just about generosity, this whole discussion here. And if you are giving so that someone gets hurt, that's not exactly the right motivation. If you're giving so you become famous, not so good. If you're giving because you want to give more than the next person, which, you know, fundraisers just love, not so good. In other words, if he only lists these three, but you could say if your giving is based on any of the reactive emotions of the six realms, then it just is a reinforcement of those realms. So those are impure motivations. And then, microphone?
I have a question about one of the impure motivations.
Okay.
Well, it's in that. It says you should not accumulate wealth for giving.
it should not accumulate?
Yes, it's in the near the end of page 186, right before C, impure recipient.
Oh, I'm not.
Oh, you're not there yet.
No, I'm. So oh, I'm sorry. Top okay. of page 186. So if you can hold on to that. Those are just wrong motivations. Lower level motivations are if I give this, then eventually I'll get wealthy. I'll get a good rebirth, or I'll get a good that. This is what Trungpa talks about in terms of spiritual materialism. The reason that this is problematic is that giving in such such an intention or motivation is still organized around a sense of self, and so you're and that's why it's firmly in the samsaric mode, because you're doing it to better yourself. Impure materials. This requires fairly careful reading. And it's a wonderful, it's wonderfully convoluted, because they want to cover, Gampopo wanted to cover all bases. The first thing is, in terms of generosity, you don't put bad stuff out in the world. So poison, fire, weapons, drugs, etc. You don't put this out in the world. Why? Because if that stuff's out in the world, it causes pain and suffering for other people. So that's basic principle. That's fine.
What about choice?
Pardon? What about choice?
What about choice?
I don't follow your question.
Well, okay, don't put bad stuff out in the world, but isn't bad a relative term? And isn't it everyone's right to choose what they deem?
What they do? Oh, it's not. Guns don't kill people. People kill people.
With guns.
That's the. That's where the NRA comes from. Guns don't kill people. People kill people.
Sorry. It's not that. I mean, but I believe that. I believe that, drugs are bad, prostitution is bad, guns are bad, all those things are bad. But I also believe that...
Believe what?
That I'm totally digressing right now.
No, I don't think you are.
No,
make
well,
your point.
I mean, I think that it's... It is truly relative what we put out there in terms of whether or not it's being good and bad. Because for one thing, even if we have a good intention, the way that it's perceived might actually be negative. And so then are we...
There are a couple of things I think that would be good to keep straight here. One of the things I think you're saying is that, okay... It's saying here we shouldn't put, give lots of weapons away. But what about individual choice? Right?
For example, I give away things that could very well cause people to contract diabetes.
Mm-hmm. Right. All your rich cooking,
or
right?
Fat.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So, again, this is what we get into. We think too much. Because, and what we tend to do, particularly in this culture, is we think too much, and we tend to think in absolute terms. That is, you make cakes and pastries and stuff, and you give it, okay? Now, because it could cause diabetes, then I shouldn't put it out in the world at all. That's absolute thinking, And the other part, and there's a whole gradation, a little bit is fine, certain amount is okay, too much, well, that's what where we have the school systems trying to get pop and soft drinks and stuff out made with corn syrup out of the vending machines out of the schools, because it makes it so available that a lot of people are contracting diabetes. They're becoming obese from drinking it. But that points to the deeper problem of moderation, which leads into your next point, which is, should the giver be concerned with the possible results, or isn't it up to the people who are on the receiving end whether they actually use it or not? And so, again, we start thinking about all of the possible ramifications. Gampob is approaching this from a much simpler point of view. What are we putting out in the world? If we put out a bunch of guns, then people are going to have a bunch of guns to use. If we put out a bunch of flowers, people will have flowers. The results of those two things are going to be quite different. You follow? Okay.
This looks remarkably similar to the lists I read about for right means of livelihood.
Oh, I would think, yeah, yeah. And that's probably from where it's derived. The next thing is very interesting, and this is where it's qualified. If that which helps is poison, then poison should be given. That is, if someone has a certain kind of disease, which will be cured by taking a certain kind of what would normally be poison, there are lots of examples of that, then you should give them that particular medicine or that particular drug. And Gampop is putting these things in because people in his age were also subject to absolute thinking. Oh, you said I can't give any poison. This person is desperately in need of this medicine, but because you told me I couldn't give poison, I can't give it to him. Yes, Kara.
This is very apropos to my life right now, what we're talking about. But does that mean that if someone needs to be, like, yelled at, then it's okay to yell at them? Like,
they're about to walk off a cliff, and they don't know it, and you yell at them.
Well, give Jesse the mic.
It just comes to mind that if, say, your child's about to walk out in the street, you can yell at them. That will save their life and prevent suffering.
Yeah. There's actually a story of Buddha's parable on exactly this topic, which the analogy is given of a father comes home to see that his house is on fire and his children are unaware of it, and he wants to get them out of the house. So instead of saying, the house is on fire, get out of the house, he says, I've just come back from town and I have these wonderful toys for you. And the children come running out of the house, and now they're out of the house and they're safe. Okay, was the father deceiving the children? and so big raging debate about this. From my point of view, we get on to... this is where the Mahayana and the Theravada parted ways, because the Mahayana, the Theravadin basically said, we simplify life so that we can reduce desire and become free of samsara. And the Mahayana developed because India at that time was moving from a purely agricultural society into a medieval society of the towns, and there was a merchant class, and trade was increasing. And the amount of wealth in the society was dramatically increasing. So then the question was, okay, how do you interact with this world rather than just withdrawing from it, which were the instructions? Or the teachings before, and that was arguably the major split, is do you seek to be awake in the world, or do you seek to withdraw from the world and wake up? And if you're going to be awake in the world, then you have to deal with things like money and interactions and all of these complexities. And the consequence of that is that in terms of morality, there is a significant shift from the action being the basis of morality, which it largely is in the Vinaya, you do this or you don't do that, to the motivation being the basis of morality. And you're talking about similar things here. One's going to have to make individual determinations according to the situation. And that's what this verse is about. If that which helps is poison, then poison should be given. Even if a delicacy will not help, then it should not be given. Because there's no point. As when one's bitten by a snake, cutting the finger can be a benefit. That's like your yelling example. Buddha said that even if it makes one uncomfortable, helpful things should be done. Now, you ask, is it okay to yell at someone if that's going to be helpful to them? Well, here it comes down to a matter of perception. How clearly do you see? And how appropriate is your action? People will use this kind of reasoning to justify things which are actually self-serving. And that's the big danger here. Okay. And I love this. You should not give your parents nor pawn your parents. Your children, wife, and so forth should not be given without their consent. This is a very, very different conception of people and so forth. Doesn't say that it was okay for the wife to give away her husband, even with his consent. I wonder why.
It probably would have been a wide open market for it.
Yeah. You should not give a small quantity while you have great wealth, because that's basically because it's not a meaningful action. It doesn't cost you anything. I should not accumulate wealth for giving. This is what you were inquiring about?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
This is a very nice subtlety. If I go out and earn a lot of money in order to be able to give, what is my relationship with giving?
Ego.
Joe?
I hear ego and self-serving around me.
And what's your opinion? I'm glad you have this support group around you.
Gathering people around here.
It's very miserly.
Bringing in the sheaves. if I save money to put my kids through college, is that accumulating wealth in order to give?
I don't think that's what Kampopa's talking about here. My guess, I'm not 100%, my guess is what he's talking about is accumulating a great deal of money so that you can then practice generosity because you think it is going to do you good. What you're talking about is exercising your parental responsibilities. I see them as quite different. Do you follow?
Yes, I'm beginning to see that difference.
Okay. Randy.
So what about working for a charity that does good things for people that need good things done for them and going out banging on doors or knocking and asking people for money or being a part of something that's raising money for a good cause?
I see that as different because it's not about you accumulating wealth for yourself that it's going to that you're going to use to benefit yourself karmically.
But you are accumulating it for the purpose of giving it away.
You're being sticky, and you know you're being sticky, Julia.
Would also there be an idea here of making a big splash?
Yeah, that's yeah.
So that sort of reminds me of that story of the man with all the wealth and the white stones there.
Well, that was Rinpoche's story about Vajrayana.
Oh, okay.
Okay, because he had to liquidate all his wealth in the form of white stones, and then said, "Who needs white stones?" And he realized, you know, so he transformed all his wealth into something. It's like the deity meditation. Okay, fine. So now, you see, it's just in another form, but now it's completely useless to you. And so you can let it go. And that's what you do with the deity practice there. So that's what that story is. Okay, yeah. Yes, please.
Could you relate that to something I'd heard in a previous class about, at that time, most of the monasteries were supported by one or two wealthy, teachers were supported by one or two wealthy people who would provide a place for them to teach, and then everyone else would do the listening. How does that fit into this generosity? Because there was one person that accumulated a lot of wealth, but he didn't really do it with the intent.
Well,
sort of after the fact of earning it, he decided to support.
Yeah. If people do this, this happens a lot in China because they take a very materialistic attitude to this kind of stuff, in Southeast Asia. But let's say I go out and I work and I accumulate a great deal of wealth so that I can become a major patron of the Dharma. That's what you're talking about. Now, in terms of the karmic processes that I'm setting in motion, good is going to come out of that just because a lot of good is being created by that. At the same time, because I'm not actually just giving it away to people, but I'm doing it in order to, and in case of this example, to be... so that I will have good karma, I'm actually reinforcing my sense of self. And that's going to create problems.
So did the monks and teachers not accept big gifts?
Oh, no, no, they were far more mercenary than that. You know, there were probably some who, if they felt that the donor was doing it for the donors, sake, would not accept it. But it is more frequently the case. There's a story from Taiwan of this person who just made very, very significant donations to a monastery for the building of a new retreat center or something like that. And he's sitting with the abbot, waiting for the abbot to thank him. And after a while, the abbot turns to him and said, "If you're waiting for me to thank you, forget it. Yeah. That would destroy any goodness that comes to you from this."
So. That's amazing.
Yeah. In Taiwan, literally, like in almost every street corner temple is sponsored by some family, and there's like a giant plaque on it that like indicates like which family is patronizing this temple,
and they're doing it all to accumulate merit, which in Chinese is luck.
Absolutely,
because the more luck you're actually accumulating luck, so good things will happen.
Well, and they burn these huge piles of ghost money, and it's all tied in.
Okay. This is spiritual materialism. Okay. Impure recipient. The essential message here is you give to people who can actually use what you're giving appropriately. Gunther says you shouldn't give alcohol, food or alcohol to gluttons or drunkards. That's how he translates this. And the reason here is that if you give to people who are just going to use it to further their own habituated patterns, no good is coming from it. So there's a sense of using some discrimination in what you're doing, trying to do good in the world with this. Impure method. Question, Linnea?
I do, yeah.
Well, people got very tired of me at the weekend in Toronto because everybody's sitting still and say, you have a question. They say, how do you know?
So exercising discrimination, what's the relationship between control, discrimination, thinking, and actually being responsive to a situation?
Remember the four steps of standing up?
No.
Show up, open to what is, serve what is true to the limit of your perception.
That's the part that I was, the limit of...
Receive the result.
Okay.
That answer it? You can only act to the limit of your perception. You cannot see more than that. If it becomes a mess, then you get to see what you couldn't see before. And you learn from that. And that's part of just receiving the result. Now, if it goes wrong, okay, it went wrong. And now you learn from that. That's receiving the result, not trying to make it, you know, think, well, I didn't, that's not what I meant. And trying to make it all right, but it isn't all right. No, okay, that didn't work out. That was a mistake. Let me learn from that and go into the next situation with that ability now to see more.
Yeah.
Okay? Yeah. I mean, we're not talking about absolutes. We're talking about a process here. And that's it. See, and I'm glad we're going through it this way because it's very important. We have a tendency, partially because of our modernist approach, where we take everything very, very literally, to read and interpret these things in terms of absolutes, rather than as a process that is unfolding. Okay. Impure method. When you're unhappy, angry, or disturbing, I'm like, yes, here's your damn $5. Not exactly. It's not exactly generosity. And also, with threatening or scolding beggars, this puts the kibosh on the Salvation Army. You know, because you know they give food, but you got to listen to the sermon. No, this is all with a different giving with an agenda. If it is actually generosity, you just give, and that's that. No strings, no conditions, etc. Okay, pure giving. I love this one. Inside material. This is those related to your body. You should give your hand to those who desire hands, your leg to those who desire legs, etc. Okay. And then in the next paragraph, those bodies, bodhisattvas, who have not fully actualized the equality of oneself and others should only give their whole body, not pieces. Oh, right. Okay, so now I give my whole body, but... Those who lack the pure intention of compassion should not give their body away. Instead, both in this and future lives, they should give it to the cause of fulfilling the great purpose. So here we have a wonderful example of the Mahayana ideal being expressed, but then being tempered so that people don't go around cutting off arms and legs and like, let's be a little practical about this. And this is very, very important because when you have stuff expressed in mythic language, there is always the danger that people will take it literally. And people do. And it's problematic. So there are stories in the literature of people, you know, giving arms and legs and things like that.
Bodhidharma, didn't that happen? His student threw his hand?
Oh, no, that was, it's, there's a story of always weeping one who was asked for, a god came down and asked for his hand. Gotta have a microphone to talk, Jesse. Otherwise, it doesn't get out there. Okay. I don't remember that story very well. I've heard of it, but I can't remember the details. But the so how do you make this practical? Those who lack the pure intention of compassion should not give their body away. Instead, both in this and future lives, they should give it to the cause of fulfilling the great purpose. What this is saying here is that until you have a very high level of realization, that is, you experience all the world as a dream, etc., etc., just work it down to practice. Don't get into this, you know, don't start chopping off limbs to give to people. Outside material, that's food, drink, clothes, conveniences, child, wife, and so forth. You see, this is coming from another age. And again, this is important because in Christian fundamentalism, they say everything in the Bible is should be taken as true. Well, yeah, but there's large sections in Leviticus and some of the earlier chapters dealing with how you handle your slaves. And, you know, absolutely straightforward recognition that, you know, these human beings were your property and here's how you manage those kinds of transactions. All of that stuff's ignored. So one of the problems with fundamentalism is that it's very selective on what it regards as fundamental. And it's usually, there's usually another agenda operating. And that's true of religious fundamentalism as well as economic and political fundamentalism. So teachings and the understanding of the teachings change and are adapted to the culture. In one sense, we have a much better, a much more fully realized culture of individual rights in this society than existed in Buddhist society. So all of the stuff about sons and daughters being things you could possibly give away just don't hold anymore at all. Then there we go to the recipients. And again, we get into a wonderful business here. Okay, you get the most merit if you give to the spiritual masters and the three jewels and so forth. And then you get lots of good merit if you give to your parents and so forth, and then sentient beings, and finally your enemies. Now, you get people who will sit and try to calculate who they should give something to so they get the maximum merit. This is a totally wrong way to approach things. Methods of generosity. It's something you actually do. That's what this boils down to. Bodhisattvas exercise giving with devotion, respect by their own hand in time and without harming others. That's all fairly straightforward. I don't think there's anything we need to go through there. Pardon? Gunter's translation? The proper time has come, gives with confidence, respect with his own hands and without harming others. What do you...
The manner of giving is that you should give with either A, good intention, or B, excellent behavior. Middle page 156.
Well, it should be both, actually. It shouldn't be either or.
I thought that's what you just said about you just give.
Yeah.
So if you can't find a good intention, at least behave properly.
Well, there's that. If you look at page in Kensho Jobson's, he translates that with an and. The methods of generosity are giving with excellent motivation and giving with excellent action.
Okay.
But, you know, you aren't lauding it over the person. You know, it is just a natural, straightforward act of giving, not making a big deal out of it. Treating the other person as another person, not as an object of charity and so forth. Now, I find it very interesting that he gives such a short thing on fearlessness, because it's actually a much more... a much stronger form of generosity. And when you think of sheltering people in times of war or persecution, etc., I mean, it's really very, very significant. And then he goes into giving the Dharma. Again, this is... You don't give the Dharma or teach, in other words, because of your concern of what it's going to do for you, even though a lot of people do, unfortunately. On top of page 119, Kensho Jeltsin, I love this. Concerning the generosity of giving the Dharma, if someone requests it, first you respond this way. I have not studied that in detail. There are several reasons for this. One is it's a practice of humility. The other is it's also a test of a person's actual interest. Do they keep coming back saying, no, I'd really like to learn this? There was another point in here. I can't remember where it actually is, but it says you don't teach people who aren't interested. And that's one of the characteristics of Buddhism. It's you only teach when it's requested. We cover this another time when you're discussing the seven-section prayer. That's actually, I think, quite an important aspect. Now, then we get into this increase section. This is where we're beginning to get to the heart of the matter. Four methods by which a person can make the act of generosity more powerful. That's what is meant by increase here. If you are completely present, then the act of generosity becomes, the perfection of generosity becomes much more powerful because it is not reinforcing any aspect of the samsaric way of experiencing things, sense of self, sense of other, etc. And so it becomes expression of awareness, pure and simple. Can expand it through the power of discriminating, this is the realization that the giver is like an illusion, the gift is also like an illusion, the recipient is like an illusion. It comes from the full realization that it is free from the three spheres. Gunter has a terribly garbled translation of this. Means to know the three elements involved to be perfectly pure. That is to say, the donor, the object of the gift, and the recipient are like phantoms. This is, I mean, this when I was studying this way, way back, we got very, very confused by this. What this means is that in the moment of giving, the sense that the idea or the framework of I'm giving something to somebody doesn't arise. One is not in that conceptual framework. You follow? And thus, the giver, the gift, and the recipient are not experienced as substantial entities. That's what like an illusion means. It doesn't mean you're looking at them and they're sort of misty or something like that, or appearing out of nowhere. And when you give that way, that is the perfection of wisdom. Yes.
Just go back to the assignment then from the previous week.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. That's what I was aiming for in the assignment. The second method of increasing the power is practicing giving as an expression of your practice, not as a or as an as an expression of spiritual practice, not as something which is going to do good in the world. So there's a change in, or a shift in context. So you may be giving something, you know, like money to a charity, which is going to do good in the world, but your own motivation is, through this act of generosity, may others... I'm doing this in order to be able to bring other beings into the path. And that's actually a very different motivation. And you aren't concerned with the result of the actual result of that. In this way, it moves from generosity in the world in which we think we live to an act in the world in which we actually live. You remember that distinction that I made in the past? And that's a very important shift. Your example, Kara, of tipping people in, you know, at Starbucks or something when they weren't looking was a good example of that. Because you were doing it to as a practice for yourself, things like that, and you were making sure there wasn't going to be any form of recognition, because that was a way you could see of developing a different relationship with giving yourself. So it's a very good example of what's being talked about here. Third, dedication. This is the idea that, again, getting away from the materialistic, spiritual materialistic, oh, I've done this good action, I'm going to get lots of merit, is that as soon as you do anything, any kind of virtue, but here the discussion of generosity, you dedicate it to the awakening of beings. And so you're reminding yourself, that's what this is about. or the awakening of all aspects of our own mind, if you want to interpret it internally. So it becomes an internal process rather than an external process that is going to improve things for you in your world. Now we come to the perfection. If one acts with emptiness and the essence of compassion, all the merit will be purified. Now, again, we have a very formal way of expressing something. You know, how do you act with emptiness? Linnaeus said it better earlier this evening, action born of emptiness, I think was your phrase. Is that right? It arises out of nothing, which is to say it is simply the response in the moment, and it doesn't come from a preconceived, strategized, conceptual framework. It just arises as the appropriate thing to do in the moment. And it is an expression of compassion. That is, it's a response to the pain and suffering of the world, or you could put it in slightly different language. It is a response to, it is addressing an imbalance. And so, and that imbalance can be internal, external, it can be anywhere. Comes down to this, it should be sealed by the four seals. Sealed by the pervading emptiness of the inner body. Again, an unfortunate translation. It means that you don't see the body. You don't see one's experience as a thing. You don't see the world as a thing. You don't see yourself as a thing. You don't even see the Dharma as a thing. In other words, you're letting go of all of those conceptual frameworks. You're letting go of all of that stuff. And it's simply a natural action. That's what the perfection of wisdom is. It's acting completely naturally as a direct, as direct knowing's response to what is arising. And it's dressed up in all this mythic language. It made it seem like this terribly unattainable thing. But it's actually extremely simple. And that's why I was asking Joe, because parents do this with their children all the time. You know, kid has a need, you just give. And that's it. And when you can actually do that in every area of your life, then you're practicing the perfection of generosity. What does Munarepa say? When attachment to a sense of self has ended, that is the perfection of generosity. You're not giving in order to be something.